When is it legal for someone to plunder your property rights? Today on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today, as usual, is my Vice Chairman, Chuck Michaelis.
Hi, Barry. Glad to be with you today.
Glad to have you here. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, as we've been discussing this week, we're talking about our basic rights. We're talking about our form of government. We're talking about our Constitution. And what we're looking at this week is our inalienable rights, or unalienable rights, I should say, as it's written in the Declaration of Independence. Those rights which are granted to us by our Creator God. The basic rights. We've talked about life. We've talked about liberty. Now we're going to turn to the pursuit of happiness. Now, before you stop and think that that means that everybody has a right to feel all warm and fuzzy inside and that government is supposed to help us by giving us things that we like and are joyful for us and comfortable, we have to step back and understand that when Jefferson and the committee wrote in 1776 that Declaration of Independence, our preamble to the preamble of the Constitution of the United States, they looked at the pursuit of happiness, they had a particular meaning, and that meaning was property rights. That is the definition of the idea of pursuit of happiness, that each individual had the right in property, had the right in and of themselves of owning property, securing property, bartering property, trading property, selling property. And that those rights were unalienable. In other words, governments couldn't take them away. As a matter of fact, our founders created our form of government specifically to, as they said in the Declaration, that they instituted those governments to secure those God-given rights. You see, because government can't give us these rights. Government can't give us life. Government really can't give us liberty, and they certainly can't give us property, even though redistribution has certainly tried to give property to others, and we're going to talk more about that later on in this program. But what we're looking at today is the whole idea of where those rights come from and why, when government loses sight of those unalienable rights, we're all at jeopardy.
I'd say one of the biggest problems that we've seen, one of the greatest inroads that those with a more top-down model of government approach is the idea that rights do come from government. And I ask, in that case, what does that mean for rights such as the right to life? Does that mean that if enough people, enough of voting population gets together and decides that we no longer have the right to life, we no longer have the right to private property, can that now be confiscated? And I believe that you're going to talk about Frederick Bastiat, who talked about legalized plunder in a conversion of a representative republic to a democratic form of government. And that idea that rights come from government is what flows out of the democratic view of government.
Yes, and you're right, Chuck. That's exactly where we're going to be going to, because, you know, when we look at our founders and we look at that formulation of the fact that we have that unalienable right granted to us by our Creator, secured by government, or supposedly secured by governments, and then when our founders operated that way and they moved toward forming the document, the Constitution, in 1787, they actually crafted restrictions, limitations, enumerated powers on that national government to make sure that there was a buffer and a protection for those God-given unalienable rights. And what happens, and what has happened in this country, is that we've lost the view of what our form of government is supposed to be. Our founders created this as a representative constitutional republic, meaning that we have representatives who vote for the interests of the people who elect them to office, and their power is divided and separated both between the branches and between the levels, the national, the state, and the local governments. So there were many safeguards, we call them checks and balances, that were put into the document to ensure that there were hedges, that there were walls separating government from our unalienable rights.
Right, and technically that's called a horizontal and vertical separation of government, where essentially you have different levels of government. You have local, county, state, and federal governments in one form of separation, and each one of those actually has checks and balances on the power of the other. And then you have, again, checks and balances and separation of power inside each level in the form of the judicial branch, the legislative branch, and the executive branches. So it, technically, what they did was, when you hear someone speak in terms of we want more efficient government, the founders were very clear that what they did not want was efficient government. They wanted government to be inefficient, to slow it down so that what couldn't happen is that a tyrant could come in or a group could capture the minds or the spirit of the age and suddenly convert these really bad laws that look really good on the surface and turn out to be horrible in practice. What they did was they wanted a cooling off period so that people could contemplate what was going to happen in some of these laws.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Now, and again, Chuck, you mentioned a little bit earlier a writer by the name of Frederick Bastiat or Bastiat. I've heard it pronounced both ways. And whichever one's most comfortable for you.
I'm going to be a little bit postmodern,
because I don't understand French.
It's French, so nobody understands how to pronounce it anyway, and probably the French don't even really know how to pronounce it.
But either way, Bastiat was an economist, and he was a philosopher who actually lived in the mid-1800s. And in 1850, he wrote a book called The Law. Now, this small treatise, which when folks take our Institute on the Constitution courses, we actually have them read this book, broken down in small chunks over the course of 12 weeks, to understand, because Bastiat makes a very compelling case between liberty and socialism. And one of the key components, as you mentioned earlier, is this concept of legal plunder. Now, you know, that sounds kind of an archaic phrase, but what it really means is when a group of people get together and decide that, you know, through controlling the levers of the government apparatus, they can then vote or appoint for themselves power and resources and potentially redistribution from you to me. If I control power, that's legal plunder. That's using the law as a weapon instead of using it for what its intended purpose is, which is to secure those inalienable God-given rights to each individual, to protect those individuals from outside harm. And, you know, we talk about, and we're going to talk about that tomorrow, I think, the only three legitimate purposes for the national government, and we're not going to spoil that today, but we'll tell you tomorrow, right. So tune in tomorrow at this time, and you'll hear about that. But that when a group of people or a group of officials get together and they start writing laws to benefit their own special interests and to take away your property rights, whether that be your financial resources, whether that be your physical property, maybe whether that be your ability to earn a living, or maybe your ability to direct the upbringing and the education of your own children. Those are your property rights, ladies and gentlemen, and governments are not supposed to be taking those away. That's what plunder is. Now, plunder is very dangerous because, as Bastiat had said in his book, In the Law, he says, it's impossible to introduce into society a greater change and a greater evil than this, the conversion of the law into an instrument of plunder. And he says, basically, because it erases from everyone's conscience the distinction between justice and injustice. And we see that today. Folks who have been paying attention in the press have heard about this Occupy Wall Street. Well, what's the big issue? Well, we want to have everybody have $20 an hour minimum wage and everybody have a higher standard of living. Well, you know, the only way that's possible is if government comes in and starts saying, well, it's not just for you to be successful when you've worked and toiled and sweated over your business. You know, Chuck here is a small business owner. Chuck, you know, basically that theory of legal plunder would say, well, you're making a profit. Well, shame on you, you dirty capitalist. We're going to rewrite the rules and regulations so that you're going to have to pay lots of licensing and fees up front for your industry so that we can make sure that you don't make too much of a profit, and then we can take those fees and redistribute them to folks who deserve it more.
Yeah, and of course, and what that does is run the price up, because as anyone who's ever run a business knows, businessmen don't actually pay their own expenses. Those expenses get passed off to the consumer as a price increase. And the fact is that what is going to happen, let's say they come in and make a $20 an hour minimum wage. Well, first of all, almost anyone who has any sense will tell you that they understand that if you raise the minimum wage to $20 an hour, the first thing that's going to happen is unemployment is going to skyrocket, because no one can afford to pay someone $20 an hour to sweep up, especially a small businessman. And the fact is that small businessmen are about between 60 and 70% of the employment in this country. So despite the fact that you hear that industrial employment is some of the most important sector, the fact is that the small businessman employs far more people. Again, these costs are passed off, and this is one of the problems. One of our presidential candidates has a plan in which there's a sales tax and a business tax, and I laugh, and I said, well, who eventually pays the sales tax? You know, let's say it's this 9% sales tax plan. Well, the fact is the consumer ends up paying the sales tax. He ends up also paying the business tax. And the bottom line is he also pays that 9% income tax. Now, his business tax portion is not going to really be 9%, because it costs money for someone like me to collect that tax, to pay it, to account for it. So I have to pay someone to do that, which means that the real cost of that tax is going to be like 12 or 15%.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I want to go back a little bit, you know, and Chuck, I think that's a great example that you've given. You know, folks, when we're looking at this, and this is how we discuss this in light of our classes on Institute on the Constitution, which if you go to our website at principledpolicy.com or at campamerican.com, you can find out more about those classes, and you can register for upcoming classes that we're having. We're going to have some in this area. We're all over the state. We're trying to host as many of these as possible so that we can educate patriotic Americans on our true heritage and the structure of our government the way it ought to be, not the way it's being effectively operated by our current crop of elected officials, but how to go about understanding, seeing how it all works together, and then utilizing that knowledge to impact your elected officials. We talked about this last night in our last class that we just did here over the summer, and that is the whole idea of discipling your civil magistrates in what they're supposed to do, because that's what a constitution is, ladies and gentlemen. It is the organizing document for our government that those officials are bound by. When they stand there, unless you're Keith Ellison, who's a Muslim, when they stand there on opening day and they put their hand on the Word of God, on the Bible, and put their right hand in the air, they take an oath, a vow. And if you understand Scripture, you understand that we're not to vow vows lightly. You are to say, you let your yes be yes and your no be no. What they say is, I swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Big problem is many of our elected officials have become those domestic enemies because they refuse to operate in the bounds of the Constitution. Now, Bastiat said, as long as it's admitted that law may be diverted from its true purpose, that it may violate property instead of protecting it, then everyone will want to participate in making the law, either to protect himself against plunder or to use it for plunder. But, you know, in 1850, he said, wait a minute. He goes, let's look at the United States. He said, there's no country in the world where the law is kept more within its proper domain, the protection of every person's liberty and property. As a consequence of this, there appears to be no country in the world where the social order rests on a firmer foundation. My, how far we have fallen. when tomorrow we're going to talk about more of that operating principle and how we get back to where we were before.
See you tomorrow.